Professor Hirschfeld, you have described a remarkable period in the history of astronomy, during which astronomers' understanding of the universe expanded from a focus on the positions of individual stars to the realization that our universe stretches to unimaginable distances in all directions and is getting larger all the time. Have there been discoveries of comparable importance since then? And if so, could you briefly describe one of them for us?
A very timely question, because as many of you may have heard, there's an entirely new branch of observational astronomy. Talk about the camera and the spectroscope, what they have done for astronomy. Now we have gravity wave astronomy. The camera, the spectroscope, the human eye, the conventional telescope, they all depend on light in some form streaming in from outer space into some detector. And that's basically our main connection to the rest of the universe, by the light that happens to wash over our Earth. Gravity waves are different. Albert Einstein, back in 1915, just over 100 years ago, likened space to a deformable fabric. There is a shape, there's a contour to space. It's completely invisible, but its effects can be measured. And of course, there have been many, many confirmatory observations of that idea. But one prediction that he made was there should be ripples in space if, say, two stars collide. Just the change in the distribution of their matter will ripple outward in this fabric of space, like ripples going out from the center of a pond. So in February of this year, a team of scientists announced that, in fact, they have observed these ripples in space-time, as they call them, these gravitational waves, very, very tiny, tiny little vibrations of space that occurred, according to our understanding, when two black holes that were spiraling around each other finally merged. And just, I think, this past week or so, there was an announcement that they had observed a second set of these gravity waves from a completely different object. So now we see the dawn of a completely new way of seeing the universe, again, by its gravity waves.
And now for another two individuals asked basically the same question, which is, where does radio astronomy fit into your story? And can you explain what radio astronomy is?
Okay, radio astronomy does not fit into this story because this story ends in 1930. Radio astronomy began during the 1940s and then took off in the 1950s. Well, you know, if we recognize that radio waves are just another form of visible light, if you take a light wave, say a red light wave, and you stretched it until its wavelength was maybe like this, that would be a radio wave. Okay, light is a form of electromagnetic energy, whatever that means. But it's a form of energy, all travels at the speed of light. And for the different forms of this energy, this light energy expanded, you just have to build a different kind of telescope. There are specialized telescopes for detecting infrared rays. There are specialized telescopes in outer space to detect X-rays. And there are likewise specialized telescopes that basically look like radio antennas, because that's what they are. But they are telescopes as well that are sensitive to radio waves. Shine a flashlight on a radio telescope, nothing is registered, but the radio waves are. So what astronomers have learned is the different kinds of objects, the different kinds of phenomena that occur naturally in the cosmos sometimes favor the emission of one form of energy versus another. So sometimes radio waves blast out into space, sometimes visible light, sometimes X-rays. So we have to study all of them. We learned not to restrict our vision of the universe to a tiny, tiny little sensitivity of the human eye.
And this is kind of a follow-up question. Is there any part of the entire electromagnetic spectrum which is not useful for the astronomer? If so, what is it and why is it not useful?
No.
Well, that was easy.
Yeah. Okay. No, I mean, there are these different forms of electromagnetic energy, and the detectors that we build, they sort of overlap so that there is no part of the electromagnetic spectrum that we ignore.
And then a couple of people want to know about the extent of the universe. One person asks, is the universe going to expand without end? And another asks, if the universe is finite, what's beyond the end of the universe?
The exact same questions that my students ask at the end of every semester. We humans are not programmed to be able to visualize all of the concepts that govern our universe, not even Stephen Hawking. So what I can say is, beyond the end of our universe, there's no space there necessarily, at least not accessible space to us. We can never see anything from out there, so it may be that there is a completely separate universe someplace not attached to ours. Maybe there are a lot of these separate universes. So, yeah, don't get a headache trying to visualize, you know, what's beyond the end of the universe. Nobody can do that. As to the expansion of the universe, so I've been teaching for 38 years, and I have seen this question posed, studied, and I think by today, answered. It's very exciting. If I look back at my astronomy notes from the late 1970s or so, nobody knows what the universe will do in the future. Well, we have made many, many different sorts of observations whose conclusions lead us to the further conclusion that the universe will expand forever. What would prevent the universe from doing that would be the gravity of all the matter in the universe. So it depends how much stuff there is, how strong that gravity is. And from our senses of matter in various parts of the accessible universe, we've determined that the density of matter is too low for its gravity to ever halt this expansion. And there is this mysterious other force. It behaves like anti-gravity. It's a repulsion. We call it dark energy because we have no clue what it is, and so we haven't come up with a good name for it yet. But what we find in our observations, that not only is the universe expanding, the expansion, instead of slowing down with time, is speeding up with time for, well, reasons to be determined. So that is a real frontier area of research to determine what is this mysterious repulsive force that is leading the universe to expand ever faster and faster. So if you're around at the end of the universe, it's going to be dark and it's going to be cold.
Well, this next question is going to be the last. Will the possibilities of quantum entanglement allow us to expand our knowledge of the structure of the universe?
I wish we had stopped with the previous one. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, what I know about quantum entanglement is that... and that's what I know. Quantum entanglement, as I understand it, when you have events occurring with a separation between them, quantum entanglement shows that the events that occur in one location actually can influence the events that are occurring in another location. It's a very, very bizarre kind of notion, and yet accepted. It's accepted. What effect this might have, you know, on the evolution of the universe, hard for me to say for sure. I would imagine that the the greater the distances you look, the smaller is this entanglement effect. But that's a guess on my part.
Well, thank you again, Professor Alan Hirschfeld, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Renee Goslin. Her topic will be a leadership issue, applying branding principles to combat unconscious bias. Thank you again, Dr. Hirschfeld, for a wonderful talk.